Chapter 48. At first, Mary found it hard to accept the truth of her good fortune. She could not quite credit that she would not be obliged to take up her pen again and write to her mother or the Bingleys, cowed and defeated, asking for permission to slink back to Derbyshire. But now she knew she was to stay with the gardeners. She was determined to do as her aunt had requested, and no longer speak so slightingly of herself. Indeed, she would attempt to go further. She would do all she could to enter into the spirit of their household, to behave with as much good humour as the gardeners did themselves. If she had been invited to join their family, it was only right she should not dampen their pleasures with sad looks and awkward silences. She would endeavour to make herself worthy of their generosity by entering as fully as she could into the Gracechurch Street life. She began by offering to instruct her young nieces on the piano. Mrs. Gardiner hesitated, asking if she understood what this would involve. She was sad to say that neither of the girls showed any evidence of talent. Would Mary not rather spend the time playing for her own amusement? But Mary would not be deterred, assuring her that she really wished to help, and in the end, her aunt capitulated. "If you are determined to sacrifice yourself, I will not stand in your way. Both Marianne and Jane should practice far more often than they do. If you could spare a few hours to keep them at their scales, I should be very glad of it." The following morning, and every subsequent day at 11 o'clock, Mary found herself sitting beside her young cousins at the piano, beating time for them and correcting their finger positions. At first, both she and the little girls were shy, but they were sunny, friendly creatures, and their reserve was soon forgotten. By their third lesson, they were chattering away freely with every appearance of pleasure. Against all her expectations, Mary too found herself enjoying the lessons, especially as her pupils began to show a marked improvement in their performance. Perhaps Lady Catherine had been right, and she would have made a good governess after all. She even began to look forward to family dinners. These were very different from the ordeals she had endured at Longbourn. At Mr. Gardiner's table, there was no teasing and no snubbing. He liked meals to be as pleasurable as everything else in life. The better she came to know him, the harder Mary found it to believe he was her mother's brother. He was so sensible, so gentlemanly, and so affable that it was impossible to credit they were such near relations. He did not stand on his dignity, and was often to be found on the carpet playing with his children, holding them in his arms and tousling their hair. They were not afraid of him, and chattered away in his presence without the slightest restraint. One night, as he shook his two noisy sons off his lap and attempted to finish his dinner, he caught Mary's eye. "No one could say these children are seen and not heard." "All the better for them, I should say. They always look very happy."
"I hope so. I hate to see children crushed and silenced by too much correction. Home should be a pleasant, laughing sort of a place, I always think. What do you say, George? Edward, what is your opinion?"
The boys nodded their agreement, their minds already on another game. Mary glanced up to see Mrs. Gardiner looking over the candles at her husband and sons. Mr. Gardiner caught his wife's eye and smiled back. It was the briefest gesture, but it seemed to Mary to contain within it all the depth of their feelings for each other. It was strange, she thought, but the gardener's mutual affection did not make her feel more alone, as she had at Pemberley, where the intensity of the Darcys' passion had left her painfully conscious of her own exclusion. At Gracechurch Street, the pleasure her uncle and aunt took in each other was felt to advantage by all around them. Mary had no doubt her nephews and nieces felt it, benefited from it. She even began to sense its effects herself. Little by little, her frozen feelings began to thaw. And as they did so, she raised her head and began to look around, curious to discover more of what lay beyond the gardener's house. At first she contented herself with short strolls to the end of the street, but soon she craved to go further afield. The city crowds no longer intimidated her as they had once done, and she soon thought herself ready to brave longer journeys. Mrs. Gardiner would not allow this until they had trod the pavements together often enough for her to be assured that Mary had mastered enough of the neighbourhood's complicated geography to be allowed out alone. Finally, she allowed it, but only when Mary swore to follow all her advice.
"Do not stray too far away. Speak to no one. And if you feel uneasy, find a respectable woman and ask for her protection."
With these words ringing in her ears, in a short while Mary was soon familiar with all the most interesting streets in the vicinity. Soon it was her habit to put on her bonnet and walk from Gracechurch Street to Cheapside and beyond, with no other object but to enjoy the atmosphere of each new place she discovered. She would never have believed she would come to take so much pleasure from losing herself in the city's crowds. There was a freedom, she concluded, in being one amongst so many, in knowing you might never again see the people who passed you so closely with such uninterested eyes. You could be anyone. No one knew who your family was or where you came from. It could not be more different from Meryton, where your name and history were common knowledge, and your past would always define you. Here, no one cared. It was a thought that gave her a little twinge of fear, but also of excitement. Chapter 49. One spring afternoon, when she returned from a walk, Mrs. Gardiner called Mary to join her in the drawing room. When Mary entered, she found her aunt sitting on the sofa with a preoccupied air. This was unusual, for she was rarely disconcerted, and as Mary sat down opposite her, she began to fear Mrs. Gardiner must have some difficult message to deliver. They chatted for a while about what Mary had seen on her outing, but eventually Mrs. Gardiner began upon what was clearly the point of their conversation.
"Since you joined us, we have lived very quietly, but that is about to change. We always become more sociable as spring approaches. It's our custom to give some little dinners and other small entertainments, simple gatherings for friends and relations whose company we enjoy."
Mary's heart began to beat faster. She was certain now that something difficult was about to be said. Perhaps if she could imagine what it might be, if she were to speak first, she could save her aunt the embarrassment of having to raise the delicate subject herself.
"Nothing extravagant, all very domestic," continued Mrs. Gardiner. "But there will be rather more social life in the house than you've been used to."
"I hope you will not feel any obligation to include me," said Mary quickly. "I will be happy to stay upstairs with the children. I have my books. I will be quite content, I assure you." Mrs. Gardiner looked at her with genuine surprise.
"Can you really suppose," she asked, "that we would arrange a pleasant dinner for family and friends and send you off into exile upstairs?"
"I would understand if you did," replied Mary. "I do not sparkle much at dinners, I'm afraid."
"Perhaps that says more about the dinners you have so far attended than it does about you," declared Mrs. Gardiner. "And anyway, in our house, no one is obliged to sparkle, which I find makes it far more likely that they might. So you will join us, I hope."
Mary knew this was not the moment to confess that the prospect of a London dinner party filled her with apprehension, but nonetheless she hesitated.
"Come, Mary, do me this favour. You might even enjoy yourself."
Mrs. Gardiner would never have hinted that she thought her niece was obliged to accept, but Mary had no doubt that she was. When she considered all the kindnesses, great and small, which had been showered upon her since her arrival at Gracechurch Street, she knew she must welcome the invitation with the simple graciousness with which it had been made.
"Thank you," she replied. "I should be very glad to join you, and I will try my very best not to disappoint you." "I know that will not happen," said her aunt, reaching for the bell and ringing for tea.
After it had been brought in, she returned to the task at hand.
"You misunderstood my meaning earlier, but you were right in perceiving I had something of importance to ask you.
Mary replaced her cup in its saucer and put it carefully on the table. She had no idea what might be coming.
If you are to become a social being, announced Mrs. Gardiner, we must dress you properly for the part. We must buy you some new clothes.
New clothes? Asked Mary.
I don't think I understand.
Her aunt put down her own cup and surveyed Mary with the wary patience of one who does not expect to carry her point without a great deal of effort.
You are a sensible girl, so I will be candid with you. What you wear now might be suitable for quiet days in the country, but will not do for evenings in town. We must smarten you up a little, my dear.
Mary flushed. It appeared that even in Gracechurch Street she was never to escape the vexed and humiliating subject of her appearance. Mrs. Gardiner reached across the table, holding out her hand to reassure her.
I know this is not an easy subject to discuss, but let me tell you how I consider such things. I see, plainly enough, that you don't like to make a fuss about dress, that you dislike having attention drawn to you, but there are times when the best way to ensure you are not remarkable is to conform to the expectations of those around you. You are a rational being. You must see that if we are to go into society, it makes sense to obey at least some of its rules.
Yes, said Mary. I made such an argument to myself once, a while ago.
Then why, may I ask, did you abandon such excellent reasoning?
I lost the heart for it. I was persuaded to buy a new dress, and the first time I wore it, I behaved very badly to someone who deserved better. I decided I did not deserve to wear nice clothes if I could not trust myself to act properly in them. This was not the reply Mrs. Gardiner had expected, and she was so surprised that she almost laughed.
Lord Mary, if that rule were to be applied universally, not a woman in London would be decently dressed.
But Mary did not return her amused smile, and Mrs. Gardiner, perceiving her obvious unhappiness, understood this was a hurt that ran very deep.
I'm sorry. I did not mean to make light of whatever it was that happened, but I beg you to consider whether your response to it was justified. Because you were unhappy once when wearing a pretty dress, it was pretty, I hope.
Handsome rather than pretty, murmured Mary, but I liked it.
I'm glad to hear it. But come, it makes no sense to assume that every time you wear something becoming, the outcome will be the same. On the contrary, as you have obviously reflected very seriously upon your actions, it seems most unlikely you will repeat them.
Mary clasped her hands round her knees, considering. It was hard to dispute her aunt's logic. She could not deny that when spoken aloud, her reasoning did not sound very sensible. There was a knock on the door as the maid arrived to clear away the tea things, but Mrs. Gardiner, clearly keen to carry on the conversation, shook her head and the maid slipped quietly away. Mrs. Gardiner topped up their cups with what remained in the pot.
It's a little stewed, she said as she handed it to Mary, but I prefer it strong myself.
She leant forward across the little table that sat between them and addressed her in a low but steady voice.
I realise this is a delicate matter, she said, but I am determined to persevere. I know you've always been told a woman's worth can be measured only by her beauty, by the way she presents herself to the world. But please believe me when I say there is a middle way between an obsession with one's appearance and an absolute denial of its importance. I do not consider myself a vain woman, but I admit it pleases me to be smartly turned out, and I would like you to feel the same.
Mary surveyed her aunt, taking in the trim figure she presented as she sat on the sofa. Mrs. Gardiner was not a beauty, but, as Mary was compelled to admit, this made little difference to the favourable impression she made. Her clothes became her. They were admirably chosen to suit her person and her situation, and in them she looked exactly as she should, smart and yet completely at her ease. It must be very satisfying, conceded Mary, to know that one presented such a pleasing face to the world, and her aunt achieved it with none of the fuss or effort with which it had been pursued at Longbourn. Staring down at her own familiar cotton dress, she began to feel impatient. Her resolution to stay hidden behind such dull and unremarkable garments began to waver. Perhaps Mrs. Gardiner was right. Perhaps the time had come to discard them and begin again.
"I'm not suggesting anything elaborate," Mrs. Gardiner went on. "We could begin with 3 or 4 day dresses and 2 for evenings. A new coat, perhaps, and certainly several hats. A straw bonnet or 2, some silk stockings rather than cotton. And we might also visit Mr. Dolland and find you a more pleasing pair of glasses."
At a stroke, the fragile image that had begun to take shape in Mary's mind of herself transformed by a few choice garments was shattered. As Mrs. Gardiner listed everything she would need to enter city life with confidence, Mary knew it could not happen. Even if she convinced herself she was worthy of buying new things, even if she accepted she was not condemned forever to hide herself beneath clothes that neither flattered nor pleased her, even then she could not do as her aunt wished. She could not possibly afford it.
"I understand what you say," Mary began, choosing her words with care. "And I admit my misgivings must look foolish when exposed to the scrutiny of common sense. I am glad to catch a glimpse of the old, rational Mary at last," said Mrs. Gardiner. "I confess I'd begun to wonder where she had gone. But even if I am persuaded by what you say," Mary continued, "I'm afraid it won't make any difference. I have no money, Aunt, with which to pay for new things."
"But I do," declared Mrs. Gardiner.
"And I should be delighted to buy them for you. It would be my pleasure."
Mary shook her head.
"I cannot think of that. I am already indebted to you in so many ways, and I cannot bear to add to my obligations."
"I am not sure there is such a thing as obligation between those who truly care for each other."
"You are very kind, but I cannot accept."
Mrs. Gardiner stood up and smoothed down her dress.
"I thought you might say that. And whilst I don't agree it is necessary, I understand your reluctance. But there is another who would like to help you, whose assistance I feel you might accept with no such embarrassment."
Mary was amazed. She begged her aunt to tell her who this person was and how they knew of her circumstances. But Mrs. Gardiner brushed away all her inquiries and instead calmly rang the bell for the servant.
"We have sat here long enough. Sarah can come in now and clear the trays."
She held out her hand to Mary in invitation.
"I know you have been out already, but I feel the need for some air. Have you yet discovered the pretty garden at Finsbury Circus? No? Then that is where we'll go. We can speak there quite freely."
Chapter 50. As Mary and Mrs. Gardiner stepped out of the front door, Mary had 1,000 questions, but her aunt was adamant she would not answer them until they reached the park. With some effort on Mary's part, they spoke of other things as they walked up Gracechurch Street and into the maze of streets beyond, and it was only when they were seated on a small bench in an enclosed green space beneath some very fine trees that Mrs. Gardiner was ready to explain.
"I must tell you that I have been in correspondence with Lizzie since you first arrived to stay with us."
Mary kicked at the gravel of the path with the toe of her boot.
"About me?"
"Yes. She was concerned when she heard you'd left Longbourn so suddenly. It was not what you had planned. She thought perhaps something had happened there to upset you."
Mrs. Gardiner paused expectantly, but Mary stared fixedly at 2 pigeons contending for a crust of stale bread. She could not bear to discuss with anyone, even her aunt, what had driven her to leave her old home.
"Anyway," went on Mrs. Gardiner, seeing that Mary was not to be drawn out, "she wanted to know how you did, and I was happy to tell her I thought you were settling down very well."
That was kind of her.
"Indeed, but her letters were so frequent that I began to wonder whether there was something more to them than merely solicitude.
It struck me there was perhaps the faintest hint of guilt about them, as if she thought she had done you some wrong and wished to be assured you were not suffering for it. Mary leapt up from the bench, alarming the pigeons. They flew off in a flutter of wings, leaving the crust on the ground. These are not matters I find easy to discuss.
I have no wish to pry, replied Mrs. Gardiner mildly. Come, do sit down. I shan't press you to say more.
Mary seemed not to have heard her. Preoccupied, she walked over to the patch of ground the pigeons had abandoned.
It is true, Lizzie once caused me a great deal of pain. It was some time ago, before our father died. It affected me very deeply, but I did not imagine she had thought much of it since.
I think we can safely say that she does think of it, replied Mrs. Gardiner. Indeed, it explains a great deal. Again she indicated the empty place beside her, and this time Mary sat down.
Lizzie often asked me if there was anything she could do to make your situation with us any easier. When she posed the question for the third time, I told her the truth, that you were in need of outfits suitable for London, and that I suspected you would not accept them from our hands. I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear she has generously offered to pay for them herself.
Mary again fixed her eyes on the ground.
I cannot take her money. Then let me attempt to protect you from your own good intentions, urged Mrs. Gardiner softly. Lizzie is rich enough not to notice 10 times the amount she intends to give you, and it would please her very much to think she had been the means of making you happy.
So I am to be mortified in order to make Lizzie feel better, cried Mary, angry now.
As I do not know what occurred between you, it is difficult for me to say, but unless she has done you some unforgivable wrong, I cannot agree it is shameful to accept a gift from a sister who, for whatever reason, wishes to make you happy.
Mrs. Gardiner opened her bag and took out a letter.
She has written you a little note, which I am to give you to make her case directly.
She passed the letter to Mary, who pulled out her spectacles and opened it.
My dear Mary, the fact you are reading this is proof that you have done exactly as I predicted and have set your mind against my present. It is entirely to your credit that your delicacy makes it hard to accept. But I hope you will change your mind. It would please me very much if you would allow me to be generous to you. I should like to make some small amends for a moment when I know I was unkind. I think we both know what I mean. I don't flatter myself that this gift excuses my behaviour, but I hope you will consider it as an apology and indulge me accordingly. E.
Mary held the letter in her hands, not knowing what to think. It touched her very deeply to know Lizzie was aware of the pain Mary had suffered that night at Netherfield, and acknowledged the part she had played in inflicting it. It moved her even more to discover Lizzie regretted her actions, even to the extent of seeking a kind of forgiveness from her. But for all that, she was still not sure it obliged her to accept Lizzie's money. She looked sombre as she folded the letter and took off her spectacles. Her aunt looked at her expectantly.
I understand that Lizzie means well, Mary began, but it is a hard thing to accept charity, even from a sister. Not only because it reminds me of my own dependence, but also because of what it implies about how I am perceived. Does everyone think I look so very dowdy? Is my appearance so odd, so very much in need of improvement, that it is considered a subject for discussion throughout the whole family?
Her voice shook a little. She was afraid she might exasperate her aunt, but Mrs. Gardiner did not seem angry.
As you clearly wish to hear the truth, rather than some easy platitudes, I shall answer as honestly as I can. It is pitching it a little high to say you look odd, but nothing in the way you carry yourself suggests you set much store by your own value. I am very far from suggesting a woman is to be judged solely by how she dresses. There are some among us who pay no attention at all to what they wear, and do so with a cheerful nonchalance. They really do not care what they look like. But that is not the case with you. Your appearance does not suggest a blithe indifference, but an acute awareness of your choices. You dress as you do because you do not believe you deserve anything better. And in doing so, you communicate that low opinion of yourself to everyone who sees you. If you were to embrace a few improvements, I believe it would signify something more than merely a desire to look a little smarter. I think it would suggest a willingness to allow yourself the self-respect you deserve, and which you have been reluctant for so long to grant yourself. Mrs. Gardiner did not seem to expect a reply, and Mary did not offer one. After a while, her aunt resumed the conversation in her usual cheerful tone. I think I've said quite enough for now, but I have one small task to perform before we leave. She pulled her bag towards her once more and withdrew from it a muslin-wrapped bundle, which she undid to reveal several large pieces of stale bread. With some gusto, she threw them towards the grass, watching with pleasure as a crowd of pigeons descended from the trees and eagerly pecked away at them. "I always bring them something when I come," she remarked, brushing the crumbs from her dress. "I like to think they know me. Well, shall we go home? I shan't press you any further about the clothes. If your conscience is too tender to accept Lizzie's gift, let us leave it alone. But please think a little about what I've said before you decide. I mean it kindly, you know." She held out her arm and Mary took it. They walked back to Gracechurch Street, both very thoughtful, but saying little on the way. Chapter 51. When they arrived back at the house, Mary went straight to her bedroom. She lay on her bed, thinking until it was almost time to go down for dinner, when she roused herself and made her way to the wardrobe. Wrapped in tissue paper at the back was the gold and cream dress. She took it out and draped it on the back of a chair, where it shone palely in the gathering dusk. She lit two candles and placed them by the large mirror, then stood in front of it, staring at her reflection, examining her hair and her figure. She held the dress up before her, and even in the darkening room, she could see how it flattered her. Suddenly inspired, she struggled out of her faded brown printed cotton and threw the gold gown over her head. She could not manage the ties at the back without help, so she left them undone. She threw back her shoulders, as she had seen Lizzie do, straightened her back, and held her head up high. She forced her features into a different expression, less abject, more assured. She could hardly believe the improvement it made. For an instant, she was a different person altogether. Mary sat down at the dressing table, her mind racing. She had been struck very forcibly by her aunt's words about self-respect, especially as they resembled so closely those used by Charlotte Lucas at Longbourn. "It is my situation I dislike, not myself." Mary knew the same could not be said of her. She had been told so often she was a failure that she had come to believe it. A woman with her disadvantages did not deserve to wear handsome clothes, nor was she entitled to enjoy the other pleasures that made life worth living. Love and affection chief amongst them. From these, too, she was excluded, and nothing, she had told herself, would change this or make the slightest difference to her future. This was how, for as long as she could remember, she had been accustomed to think. But Mrs. Gardiner's cool reasoning had somehow robbed this familiar, dark vision of much of its power. For the first time in years, Mary found herself questioning why she had so willingly resigned herself to such a miserable fate. Where was it written that her destiny was fixed? Why should she not, by her own efforts, seek to change it? She shivered, and knew her tremor indicated something more than the chill of the room. It was shock, too. The shock of understanding that the gloomy certainties which had sustained her for so long were loosening their grip upon her.
She pulled the gaping dress around her to prevent it slipping off her shoulders and put her head in her hands, trying to think. Suddenly, the line which Mr. Collins had transcribed for her burst into her mind. Happiness depends on ourselves. The saying was familiar enough. She had read it many times and had even copied it into her book of extracts. But as it ran through her head, she realized that she had never really absorbed its meaning. It had made no impact on the way she thought of herself. In that respect, her mother's ideas still loomed larger than those of Aristotle. She had been unable to free herself from Mrs. Bennet's conviction that happiness arose from drawing the winning tickets in the lottery of life, especially those of a pretty face and a graceful figure. Then she arrived at Gracechurch Street and everything changed. There she saw what true happiness looked like. And for the first time in her life, she understood what it felt like to be wrapped in its embrace. At Pemberley, she had been an observer, watching the contentment of others from the margins. But in the gardener's home, she was included, invited in, and immersed in their kindness. For a while, she had allowed herself to simply bask in such an unfamiliar pleasure. But it had not been long before her inquiring mind awoke, and she began to look around Gracechurch Street with a questioning eye, asking how the gardeners had achieved their happy state. It was only now that she finally grasped how it was done. As she saw, with a flash of comprehension, that Aristotle had a far better idea of how happiness was to be achieved than Mrs. Bennet. The happy contentment which defined life at Gracechurch Street was not the product of beauty, wealth, or luck. It was true the gardeners enjoyed some marks of good fortune, a comfortable income, and good health chief amongst them, but none of them was outstandingly handsome, and they possessed no broad acres or rolling parklands. In fact, thought Mary, it might be argued that many of the same advantages from which they benefited had been equally bestowed upon Longbourn, but without producing a comparably happy state. No, she decided, her ideas solidifying in her mind, the difference was that the gardeners worked hard at the business of happiness, exerting themselves tirelessly to coax it into being. They did not consider happiness a matter of chance or destiny. Instead, they did everything in their power to cultivate it, prizing generosity over petulance, preferring kindness to umbrage, and always encouraging laughter rather than complaint. The result was the happiest home Mary had ever known. If anyone might be said to have made their own happiness, she concluded, it was her uncle and aunt. She sat up straight, alert and thoughtful. If her uncle and aunt could do it, why should she not follow their example? She was a good scholar, and surely this was only a different kind of lesson that she could train herself to learn. She might begin by adopting some of the habits of mind that served them so well. None of the gardeners were ashamed of themselves. Perhaps she could persuade a little of their confidence to attach itself to her. She could try and smile more and frown less, telling herself that not everything she said was dull and awkward. It would not be easy to shift the inclinations of a lifetime, but she was sure she was ready to try. Excited, she walked to the window and pushed up the sash, leaning out into the darkening evening. The lights of the Gracechurch Street shops glowed yellow, and the smell of coal smoke hung acrid in the air, but she did not mind. She had never expected she would grow to love London, but its sights and sounds, which had once seemed so overpowering, now seemed exhilarating and full of promise. She could not remember when she had last felt so eager, awake, and ready for something new. She took a deep breath of cool air and closed the window. The most important habit to conquer was the habit of misery itself. Nothing was so inimical to happiness as the settled conviction it was not for her. It was a conviction that ran very deep in her, but she knew she must fight to rise above it. As she passed the mirror, she caught sight of herself, her dress hanging loose at her shoulders, her shawl wrapped untidily around her, her face a little flushed from the night air. She cut a dishevelled figure, she thought, picking up a fold of the glittering gold dress and running it gently through her hands. The delicate silk felt pleasurable to her touch. If she was to open herself up to the possibility of happiness, where better to start than with the purchase of some new clothes? She would write to Lizzie tomorrow, signifying her readiness to accept her kind offer. She would make sure it was a cheerful letter. She would begin as she meant to go on. Chapter 52. When their carriage pulled up outside a magnificent stuccoed building with a tall pillared entrance, Mary was convinced the coachman must have mistaken the address.
"Can this be right? It looks more like a palace than a shop."
Mrs. Gardiner gathered together her cloak and gloves, eager to begin.
"That is exactly what you're supposed to think. But I promise you it is a shop, although a very grand one. Mr. Gardiner always says there is nowhere in the world quite like Harding and Howell, and I do not argue with him. If we cannot find what we want here, it is simply not to be had."
As an established Londoner of some 3 weeks, Mary imagined that in her walks around Cheapside, she had already encountered the most lavish displays of goods the capital had to offer. But as she followed her aunt through the shop's great doors, she realized she could not have been more wrong. She had never seen anything like Harding and Howell. In both size and magnificence, it was incomparable. Room after room opened out before her, each with its own distinct offering of beautiful things. Mahogany counters shone in the light that poured in from high windows. At some, gentlemen stood examining cravats. At others, ladies looked closely at stockings.
"We did very well to come so early," said Mrs. Gardiner as they strode past a display of hats. "If you arrive after 11, the queues are intolerable."
When they arrived in the fabric hall, the sight was even more splendid. Every wall was lined with wide shelves reaching up to the ceiling. Upon them, bolts of every kind of cloth were stacked. Cottons, poplins, muslins and lawns. Long swathes of silk hung from tall poles, showing off their colours and patterns to glorious advantage. On a table in the centre of the room were spread out the most beautiful paisley shawls Mary had ever seen. This shimmering palace of fabrics could not be more different from the dark little haberdashers at Meryton.
"It is magnificent, is it not?" whispered Mrs. Gardiner, as they sat down at one of the broad counters.
They were attended to by a very superior assistant, whose immaculate clothes made Mary painfully conscious of the shortcomings of her own. She thought she saw his eyes flicker over her unremarkable outfit, but once reassured by the amount Mrs. Gardiner intended to spend, his manner was quickly all consideration and attentiveness. They began with muslins. Mary could not believe how many were laid before her, all miracles of lightness and delicacy. At first, the sheer extent of the choice seemed to make it impossible to decide, for there was always something more to see. But gradually, she found her eye and began to discover what she liked. With growing confidence, she decided first upon a spotted pink and then a rich, glowing cream. The cottons proved more difficult, for they came in so many colours and patterns. Each fresh example seemed as alluring as the one before. Eventually, she fixed upon a yellow and white stripe and a lavender ground decorated with cream leaves, though for her final choice, she could not decide between a design of green and gold or one of blue and grey. As she turned over the samples, Mary could not quite credit how much she found herself enjoying an occupation she would not long ago have dismissed as frivolous. How was this to be explained? Part of it, she thought, was simple. She had closed her ears to her usual scruples and allowed herself to enjoy the physical pleasure of handling such beautiful things, running them through her hands and admiring the texture and feel of them. But she knew she would never have dared attempt it if her mother or Lydia had been there to witness it. They would have laughed at her change of heart. Mrs. Bennet would have been scornful, and Lydia could never have resisted the opportunity it offered for a good tease. In London, however, there was no one to judge her. Here, she thought, she might alter everything about herself if she wished to, and if that meant finding satisfaction in handsome cottons, then so be it. Soon she was so absorbed once more in comparing the different patterns that, until he was almost upon them, she did not notice a young man making his way towards their counter, his hand raised in greeting. Mrs. Gardiner sprang up, delighted to see him.
"Mr. Heywood, whatever are you doing here?"
"Nothing very particular, I'm afraid," the young man replied with a polite bow. "I left home with the definite intention of buying myself some gloves, but so far I've done nothing but saunter about." Mrs. Gardiner laughed.
"Men have so little sense of urgency when it comes to the business of buying. We, on the other hand, have set ourselves diligently to the task and have already acquired a very respectable number of purchases."
"You have begun as you mean to go on, then?"
"Indeed we have."
Mrs. Gardiner turned to Mary, who looked up a little uncertainly, but did her best to produce a welcoming smile.
"Mr. Heywood, may I introduce my niece, Miss Mary Bennet? We're not leading me astray amongst the muslins. She is staying with us at Gracechurch Street. Mary, this is Mr. Thomas Heywood, the son of a cousin of mine, a good friend of all us gardeners and a frequent guest in our house."
Mr. Heywood was tall and broad-shouldered, with a shock of dark hair. He was not particularly handsome, but his expression was so affable and amused that by the time this fact was noticed, it was too late for it to matter.
"I am proud to be both distant relative and close friend," he declared, "for one might be said to have led to the other. Are you up from the country, Miss Bennet?"
Mary made herself speak up clearly, determined to allow no hint of a blush or mumble.
"Yes, sir. I am quite new to town."
"And how are you enjoying it?"
"I was a little overwhelmed at first, but the better I get to know it, the more I like it."
"Exactly the right answer. I am a great advocate for London, and hate to hear it criticised. After all, where else could we find ourselves in such a building as this, where the best that commerce and industry can afford is offered to us all under one roof?"
His enthusiasm was so open and infectious, his expression so encouraging, that Mary found it easy to reply,
"Yes, sir. I must admit, I have never been anywhere like it. They have cottons and silks in every colour of the rainbow, including some so extraordinary they have yet to be given a name."
"Well, perhaps we should set ourselves to supplying that deficiency," mused Mr. Heywood. "It is very inconvenient not to be able to ask for exactly what one wants. What do you think of Coromandel, for that fiery shade between red and orange hanging over there? Or Jonquil, for the rather queasy tone of yellow to your left?"
"Now, Tom," said Mrs. Gardiner severely, "you are not to inflict your whimsy on poor Miss Bennet before she has had a chance to know you. She will not know what to think."
Unabashed, Mr. Heywood drew up a chair and seated himself at the counter beside them.
"You are quite right," he replied, with a good-natured air which suggested this was not the first time Mrs. Gardiner had scolded him in this way.
"I promise to conduct myself hereafter in a manner that will neither surprise nor entertain. I shall be exactly as dull as politeness requires."
"I'm sure there is some happy medium between the two," observed Mrs. Gardiner.
"Then I shall certainly endeavour to find it."
He smiled at her aunt, and Mary saw immediately how fond they were of each other.
"So, Miss Bennet," he went on in a more formal voice, "you are in the very best place to find materials of every kind. The quality here is excellent. May I be allowed to see what you have chosen?"
"Really, sir?" asked Mary, puzzled. "Do you honestly wish to see what I have been looking at?"
"Well, indeed I do," insisted Mr. Heywood. "I'm reckoned an excellent judge of cottons and muslins, though not silks. Silks are not my province at all."
Mary glanced at him to see if he was making game of her, but obediently she passed him the book of samples she had been examining.
"We cannot decide,"
she said, between the blue and the green. It felt very strange to be discussing such matters with a man she had barely met, but Mr. Haywood was not disconcerted. He looked at both swatches closely and felt them between his fingers.
You should take the green. It will wear better.
Now you are teasing me, sir. He closed the book, as if all was now decided.
Well, perhaps a little.
But you really should choose the green, on grounds of beauty, if not of utility. It is a very handsome pattern. I think it would suit you. Mary felt herself begin to blush and look down once more at the swatches.
How did you come to know so much about cottons, sir? She asked.
Are you in the trade yourself?
Oh, no, he said, laughing a little. But I had a very good apprenticeship, with four sisters, all older than me. It was impossible I should not learn something about the intricacies of dress. I grew up surrounded by hems and flounces.
An excellent qualification, remarked her aunt. But is it enough for us to take his advice?
Mary hesitated. She was not sure she wished to be so easily influenced by a man who was quite unlike anyone she had encountered before.
I see I may have confused matters by giving my opinion too decisively, said Mr. Haywood soothingly. Please let me make amends. May I offer you some tea? There is a refreshment room here with an admirable view of the park. Miss Bennet can reflect on the contesting virtues of her cottons over a toasted tea cake.
In the circumstances, said Mrs. Gardiner, I think that is the very least you can do.
Chapter 53. Mary and her aunt made their excuses to the shopman, who promised to keep the samples in readiness for them until they returned, and together with Mr. Haywood, they made their way through a series of colonnaded rooms until they arrived at a salon, whose tall windows overlooked the trees and lawns of St. James's. Once they were settled, with tea and cakes laid out before them, Mrs. Gardiner turned to Mr. Haywood with an inquiring look.
So, Tom, are you writing anything just now? It's a while since I've had the pleasure of reading something of yours. Is there a work on the stocks, as I believe you writers say?
Mary put down her cup, suddenly alert and interested.
Are you an author, sir?
Indeed he is, replied Mrs. Gardiner. He has written several extremely interesting pieces.
Your aunt is very kind, said Mr. Haywood, laying down his slice of fruitcake. But I fear author is a title I don't really deserve. It suggests far too much. I have contributed a few articles to magazines, but as a reviewer of the work of others, rather than producing something original of my own.
But that is not to be dismissed, ventured Mary. The work of the critic is essential to the formation of correct taste, and it must be a wonderful thing to support yourself by your pen.
Yes, Miss Bennet, I'm sure it is. But I cannot lay claim to such distinction. I am a lawyer, ma'am. He poured himself another cup of tea and returned to his fruitcake.
And a very good one, added Mrs. Gardiner. He has finished eating his dinners at the Temple and is a barrister.
Quite a junior one, I'm afraid.
But not for long, I am sure, said Mrs. Gardiner indulgently. We have great hopes for you, Tom.
Do you write about legal matters, then? Asked Mary. Constitutional questions, perhaps? No, I do not. The law is my profession, but my passion is poetry.
Mary could hardly believe what she heard. To meet a man who wrote for magazines was surprising enough, but to discover the subject of his pen was poetry was doubly astounding. She was not sure how she imagined such a person might look and sound, but Mr. Haywood, with his frank, open manner, dark, curly hair, and healthy appetite, was not what she would have expected.
Poetry, sir?
Poetry, ma'am. Do you care for it yourself?
I cannot say I do. I used to read Young's Night Thoughts quite often, but I haven't looked at it for many years.
If that gloomy verse was your sole experience of the poetic art, I'm not surprised you gave it up. Have you really read nothing more recent?
I'm afraid not. Or if I have, I do not remember it.
For the first time since Mary had met him, Mr. Hayward was now wholly serious. Serious enough to put down his second piece of cake and throw his napkin onto the table.
Really, Miss Bennet, this is a sad thing to hear. You cannot remain in this unenlightened state. You must allow me to introduce you to some newer works. If my favourites don't affect you as they do me, don't strike you speechless with admiration, then I promise never to mention them again.
Let us not begin upon poetry now, said Mrs. Gardiner, looking warily at Mr. Hayward.
Once we start, we shall never stop, and we still have shopping to do.
Mr. Hayward looked sheepish.
Yes, he admitted, I tend to bore on the subject if not checked.
Oh, no, sir, said Mary earnestly. It is very exciting to hear someone speak with such conviction about things of the mind.
Mr. Hayward's gratified smile encouraged her to go on. My ignorance of modern poetry is a great weakness in my reading, and one I should very much like to remedy, she said hastily, as if to get out what she wished to say before her courage failed her.
If you were kind enough to make any recommendations, you can be sure I would apply my mind to them very assiduously.
I'd be honoured to do so, said Mr. Hayward, although I think once you begin upon them, you'll see that your mind will take you only so far in appreciating them. They must be read with the heart as well as the head.
He looked at her steadily. It was Mary who turned away first. Then the waiter arrived at the table to ask if they required anything more. He clearly wished them to take their leave, and Mrs. Gardiner began to prepare herself to go.
It appears we have outstayed our welcome and must be off, she said. We shall return to our silks and cottons, but you and Tom may continue your conversation at our next dinner. Mr. Hayward is one of our regulars, so he will have every opportunity to persuade you to share his enthusiasms when he is next at Gracechurch Street.
Mr. Hayward stood up and bowed again. I very much hope so. I shall endeavour to make a poetry lover of you yet, Miss Bennet, and I urge the green and gold stripe upon you. I promise you will not regret it.
Mary said her farewells and followed her aunt away from the table. When they reached the door, she could not resist glancing back. Mr. Hayward was occupied in paying the waiter whilst an impatient couple quickly claimed possession of their vacated chairs. She turned away hurriedly. She would have been deeply embarrassed if he had seen her looking. She was glad when her aunt took her arm and they began to make their way back to the fabric hall.
Tom Hayward is a great favourite of mine, Mrs. Gardiner confided as they passed a great display of gentlemen's handkerchiefs. He is one of the best-natured men I know, excepting Mr. Gardiner, of course. I have known him since he was a boy and cannot recall him saying an unkind word.
He was in an excellent humour today, replied Mary. It seemed as though he found everything around him amusing.
Yes, admitted her aunt. If Tom has a fault, it is that he is inclined to be whimsical. He gives in too easily to flights of fancy, sometimes to entertain others, and sometimes, I think, merely to please himself. I have mentioned it to him before. You will have observed I did so today, but I'm afraid he doesn't attend.
Suddenly Mrs. Gardiner came to a halt, struck by the appearance of a pair of gloves that, from a distance, seemed to be exactly what she had been looking for. But on closer inspection, they revealed themselves to be the wrong shade of yellow, and they walked on, Mrs. Gardiner returning once more to the subject of Mr. Hayward.
Tom is naturally of a very lively disposition, she went on, and does love to exercise his wit. It would be a great mistake, however, to imagine that because he is inclined to be jocular, he is incapable of serious feeling. Underneath his light-hearted manner, there is a very thoughtful young man, as steady and sensible as anyone I know.
As a lawyer, I should have thought those were essential qualities if he hoped to rise in his profession.
Indeed, and I understand he is very highly regarded at the Inns of Court. Mr. Gardiner says that in his professional capacity, Tom is always exacting and precise, quite unlike the easygoing character he chooses to adopt when amongst his friends.
They had arrived at the counter once more,
Chairs were pulled up for them. The shopman retrieved the book of samples they had been studying and placed it with a flourish before them. But Mrs. Gardiner was as yet reluctant to relinquish the interesting subject of Mr. Haywood and return to the cottons.
"It is a strange thing, Mary, but in my experience, most men like to think of themselves as serious beings. They cultivate a sense of dignity and enjoy being considered grave and severe. But it is quite the opposite with Tom. He prefers to hide his seriousness away. It appears now and then, of course, but he does not care to broadcast it."
"Perhaps," suggested Mary, "spending so much time with lawyers has exhausted his appetite for sobriety. Maybe he fears becoming as pompous as they are if he does not cultivate a livelier turn of mind."
"I suppose that is possible," agreed Mrs. Gardiner. "And he comes from quite a numerous family, so he will have been obliged to speak up and tell a joke or two in order to be heard. You mentioned he is a relative of yours?"
"His mother is a cousin of mine, somewhat older than myself. She married Tom's father as his second wife. They lived happily until his death 2 years ago. I have not seen her since then, but we still write to each other."
Mrs. Gardiner opened the book of samples, as if to begin upon the cottons once more. But now it was Mary who seemed reluctant to abandon the interesting topic of Mr. Haywood.
"So are the sisters Mr. Haywood mentioned the daughters of your cousin or his first wife?" "They are my cousin's daughters. All of them are married now. Her husband had a son by his first marriage, and he inherited the family estate. As the younger boy, Tom always knew he would have to make his own way in the world, and to his credit, he has done so with admirable determination and very good grace."
Mary was silent for a moment, absorbing all she had heard.
"And what about the poetry?" she asked. "Where does that passion come from?"
"Lord!" exclaimed Mrs. Gardiner. "I really cannot say. That's too deep a question for me to answer. You'll have to ask him yourself."
She looked at the great clock on the wall.
"And on that note, I think we must leave Tom alone and return to our shopping. Have you made a decision yet?"
Mary glanced quickly at the samples and closed the book, much to the relief of the shopman, who had approached with a questioning air.
"I believe Mr. Haywood may have been right about the green," she said. "I do believe we should take it."
Once Mary's dresses were ordered and being made up, Mrs. Gardiner turned her mind to Mary's spectacles, carrying her to see Mr. Dolland, the oculist. There, Mary's eyes were examined again, and her glasses studied closely.
"The lenses are of excellent workmanship for a country practice," observed Mr. Dolland, "but I think we may provide you with something a little more tasteful in the way of a frame."
"They were made for me by a very talented young man," Mary replied in a low voice. "I believe he is now studying at one of the hospitals here in London."
"Where, no doubt, he will do very well, if this is an example of his capabilities. Now, ma'am, may I beg you to look in this direction?"
Mary peered through pair after pair of spectacles. Once the consultation was over, she chose two handsome examples with delicate silver frames, which Mr. Dolland urged upon her.
"Much more suitable to a young face, I feel. Do you want to keep the old ones? I can dispose of them, if you wish."
Mr. Dolland held out the glasses on a clean white cloth. Next to the new ones, they seemed heavy and perhaps a little clumsy, but Mary's heart contracted a little as she looked at them.
"I should like to keep them, if you please."
He handed the old spectacles to his assistant, who wrapped them carefully in cotton wool. Once back in Gracechurch Street, Mary carried the little package to her room and gently unpacked it. She held the spectacles in her hands, thinking of everything that had happened since the day in the Longbourn drawing room when John Sparrow had shyly declared his intention to grind the lenses himself. That world was gone now, its inhabitants scattered and dispersed. It could never be recovered. What was done was done. She raised the spectacles to her lips and kissed them gently before folding them up in the cotton wool. Then she opened her dressing table drawer and placed them carefully at the very back, next to the little Greek dictionary. As for Mr. Haywood, she did not allow herself to think of him at all. It was only after she had blown out her candle and fallen asleep that he sprang unbidden into her mind. There was nothing she could do to prevent him appearing in her dreams, gazing at her quizzically whilst holding a book of poetry in one hand and carrying a length of the green and gold cotton in the other. Chapter 54. On the night of the gardener's first dinner, Mary found herself in the unfamiliar situation of having a choice of new clothes to wear. It did not take her long to decide upon the gown made up from the pale cream muslin she had bought at Harding and Howell, which had turned out just as simple and elegant as she had hoped, with not a flounce or a lace trimming to be seen. Mrs. Gardiner's maid put up Mary's hair into a smooth chignon, with only the smallest curl attempted at the sides. She refused all other ornaments. As she stood before the mirror, examining the result of her efforts, Mrs. Gardiner appeared at her door.
"Ah, that is a great improvement. The colour gives you a little warmth, which helps your complexion. The style looks well on you. Indeed, the whole effect is very pleasing."
To a beautiful woman accustomed to extravagant compliments, this would not have seemed like much, but its sincerity delighted Mary. She stared at her reflection one last time and decided that she too was satisfied with what she saw. She would not embarrass the gardeners, dressed as she was. She could take her place amongst their party with as much assurance as anyone else. She was nervous, but the knowledge she would not look an oddity at her first London dinner gave her the courage she needed to face it bravely, and even with a little excited anticipation. There were 20 people at the table, and Mary was relieved to find them talkative and lively. They were all city people who knew each other too well to stand on ceremony, and soon the conversation flowed freely, with steadily increasing volume. Once a gathering of this kind would have made Mary painfully aware of her own isolation, but she had been relieved to find herself seated next to Mr. Haywood, who soon put her at ease. He introduced her to her neighbours, made sure her wine glass was never empty, and helped her to the oyster patties with which the dinner began. In a low voice, he explained who everyone was, discreetly indicating the wealthy banker, the powerful alderman, the cultivated tea importer, and the wife of London's largest greengrocer. His manner was so genial and his conversation so entertaining that she soon forgot to be self-conscious. When she looked around and took in the splendid dining room, illuminated by more candles than she had ever seen in one place, whose light sparkled against the gilt mirrors and gold picture frames, she did not retreat into herself, calculating how soon it would all be over, but instead gave herself up to enjoying the spectacle, never thinking for a moment that she did not belong there. When she and Mr. Haywood had exhausted the topic of their fellow guests, it was an easy step to begin discussing themselves. And as the main course was brought in, Mary asked him how he had come to choose the law as his profession. But before he could begin to answer, a fine shoulder of veal was passed in their direction, and it was not until he was satisfied that she had as much of the dish as she wanted that he was ready to reply. "It is often said we younger sons have only three careers to choose from, the church, the army, or the law. And as I thought myself entirely unsuited to the first two, it was inevitable I should end up in the third."
"Really, Mr. Haywood?"
A servant filled her glass with wine. Perhaps it was that which gave her the boldness to continue.
"You do not strike me as the kind of man who decides upon his life's occupation merely because it is, well, I shall not say the lesser of three evils, as that would be disrespectful to the clergy, but I think you know what I mean."
Mr. Haywood looked amused. "Yes, I cannot deny it. There were many other considerations that propelled me towards the law. As you may have noticed, I enjoy the sound of my own voice, an essential qualification for a barrister."
"So I have been told," persisted Mary, "but I cannot believe that eloquence is the only quality a lawyer requires. It must also demand a good understanding and a great deal of study, the getting of quantities of facts by heart."
You speak as if you imagine those things beyond me.
Why, no, sir. Our acquaintance has been, as yet, too brief for me to make such a judgment. Shall you have some cheese? I can hand it to you if you wish.
Really, Miss Bennet, I am most dreadfully affronted. You seem to suggest I am incapable of applying myself to weighty subjects. I cannot think of taking any Stilton until I have been allowed to defend my character as a most diligently dull student of the law.
You will excuse me if I try some. Mary took a very small piece of cheese and placed it carefully on one of Mrs. Gardiner's best Wedgwood plates. I did not mean to imply you were incapable of serious study. On the contrary, I do not imagine you could have achieved your current place in your profession without it. You must have worked long and hard to master its principles, and to me that suggests you have more fondness for it than you like to admit. I think you chose the law not because your other choices were so few, or because it allowed you to exercise your skill in argument, but because there was something in it that you enjoyed and wished to pursue. Mr. Hayward, who had watched her closely as she spoke, now laughed once more.
A hit, he exclaimed. A palpable hit. You have clearly missed your own vocation, Miss Bennet. You would have been a most formidable addition to the bar.
He reached for the cheese and cut himself a piece. You are quite right, however, he continued. I went into the law because a part of my mind finds it deeply satisfying. I enjoy its precision and exactness, its attempts to comprehend every eventuality, to provide for every possible occurrence, and to do so with as much cool, calm, one might say indifferent, rationality as possible. The language of the law, which so many find dull and arid, is fascinating to me.
I knew you could not devote yourself to a profession in which you had no real interest, declared Mary, triumphant. It took a little effort for you to confess it, but I was certain it was the case.
I'm not sure a taste for the dustier recesses of the law is a thing one would want generally known, said Mr. Hayward ruefully. But as it seems to have raised me in your estimation, I am prepared to admit it.
Mary felt her face grow warm. She was not sure whether the cause was Mr. Hayward's amused gaze or her uncle's wine, of which she had drunk more than usual. The noise around the table suggested she was not the only guest who might have done so. There was a cheer as the servants came in, carrying three large trifles and a great number of spoons.
And yet you have no such inhibitions about declaring your love for poetry.
No, that is a pursuit of which I have never been ashamed.
May I ask where your passion comes from? Mary could not quite believe she was asking more questions, but she could not stop. Has it always been so marked a taste for you?
I cannot remember when I did not care for it, replied Mr. Hayward simply. I have loved it since I was a boy.
And do you write verse as well as read it? I imagine the two impulses are often found in company.
Indeed, they go together as well as this excellent trifle and this jug of cream. Will you take a little?
Mary shook her head. It was impossible she should ever eat another mouthful. Even Mr. Hayward seemed defeated and pushed away his plate.
Yes, I tried to write, he said. I tried very hard. Like many other foolish young men, I believed that because I loved poetry so sincerely, I must be able to write it too. But I was wrong. I could not do it.
That must have been a great sadness to you.
At the time, I thought it was the end of the world.
He smiled in recollection of his youthful grief.
Now I am thankful I understood my limitations so early. If I don't have the genius to create a thing of beauty myself, at least I have the judgment to appreciate the art of others. It is better to accept what I can do than to yearn hopelessly after what I cannot. Know thyself, as the Greeks tell us.
Mary murmured a phrase, quite low, almost to herself.
Really, Miss Bennet, that sounded very like Greek, remarked Mr. Hayward. Could it have been?
It isn't a language with which young ladies are usually familiar.
Oh, cried Mary, embarrassed at having revealed knowledge she was not expected to possess.
I really know very little, only the alphabet, some grammar, and a few quotes from the great philosophers. I was taught it by a friend of the family.
You are full of surprises, replied Mr. Haywood. I look forward to learning that you also draw in the Chinese style, or have lately prepared your own translation of Goethe.
Mary was suddenly wary. Was he mocking her? She could not bear it if he was. Mr. Haywood caught her anxious expression.
I see I have upset you. Oh, please understand, that was not my intention.
He appeared genuinely distressed as he sought to make amends.
My words were ill-chosen. I will always attempt a witty remark, even when I had far better not. But I did not mean to tease you. A cultivated mind is a wonderful thing in a woman, and should be everywhere encouraged, not despised. If I gave the impression I thought otherwise, I am sorry, and ask for your forgiveness.
It was impossible to doubt either his candour or his concern, and Mary felt relief flood through her. She could not recall when she had enjoyed anyone's company so much, and it would have been painful for the evening to end on an uncomfortable note. For there could be no doubt now that the dinner was coming to a conclusion. The plates had been cleared, and the crumbs were being swept from the cloth. For the first time she could remember, Mary did not welcome the prospect of its being over. She had no desire to hurry away.
You are very kind, but the offence, such as it is not all on your side.
I too have a case to answer, for I prodded and poked you about so many things, poetry and the law, and you bore it all with the utmost patience.
Well, replied Mr. Haywood, his cheerfulness restored, if we are both equally at fault, can I suggest a plan of restitution? You shall recommend a book for me to read that you believe will improve me in some way, and I will do the same for you. The terms are these. The work must be read in its entirety, no skipping, and a full account of the sensations it produced is to be given by the reader to the recommender before a period of not more than 14 days has expired. What do you say?
Mary was delighted. There was nothing she would enjoy more.
I am pleased to accept your terms and will do all I can to discharge my obligations as required.
The noise at the other end of the table had now increased to such an extent that ordinary conversation was no longer possible, for one of Mr. Gardiner's friends had announced his intention to favour the party with a song. Knowing that a gesture must take the place of words, silently Mr. Haywood raised his glass to toast their agreement, and Mary, shyly, lifted hers.